Hi, welcome to the Hard Bop Audio Tour Podcast. So the idea here is not to replicate something that happens in lectures. In fact, this is going to be totally different from what we did in class. I'm going to play more clips. I'll talk over them. The idea is to introduce you to a wider variety of artists than I could cover in class. Your job is to listen to the overall sound and get an idea of what hard bop is. Remember in class, I said that hard bop was a particularly wide genre. That meant that lots of different types of music fall into this subcategory of hard bop. So I want you to think now about how I should present this material, right? What classification system should I use? How should I present this? I've chosen to present it as a spectrum from the most commercial to the least commercial. That's kind of an arbitrary decision, and I want you to think about why I might have done that, or how else you might do it. It's a kind of taxonomy of hard bop. I'm assuming there's some zoology majors out there. Think of why we classify things the way we do. Now, I could have done this alphabetically. I could have done it chronologically. I could have done it in terms of value from best to worst. Think about how we use classification systems and why we use classification systems. Are they true? Or do they represent something about the person who's doing the classification? Okay, we're going to start by listening to some Jimmy Smith. Jimmy's the father of the Hammond organ. This is a piece called Messy Bessie from the album Back at the Chicken Shack. You're going to remember the references we talked about. Can you imagine a white performer using this title, Back at the Chicken Shack? Anyway, it's a blues. What you're hearing is called an organ trio. So you've got the organ, which has foot pedals. So there's no need for a bass. You just heard Kenny Burrell enter there on guitar. Donald Bailey's playing drums. You should be able to hear organ with the foot pedals, guitar, and drums. It's called an organ trio. That's Stanley Turrentine playing tenor sax. Stanley's from Pittsburgh. Played rhythm and blues with Ray Charles before joining Max Roach, and now here with Jimmy Smith. So think of the associations you have about the organ. Right? This is a church instrument. So Jimmy Smith is literally the first guy to take the organ out of the church and say, hey, I can play rhythm and blues or I can play jazz with the organ. You can imagine how this was received. So this is almost kind of a pop music. It's really grooving. This is from 1960. So Jimmy Smith then moves to Verve Records in 1963 and has a string of hits. Again, some of his fans would say, well, he's on Verve. They over-commercialized him. Here's one that includes a big band, almost a pop album. It won a Grammy Award for Best Original Jazz Composition, however. It's called The Cat, and it's by Lalo Schifrin. So yeah, definitely the Austin Powers going on here. That's from 1964. That's Jimmy Smith. Hopefully you can hear how this really is almost a kind of pop music. It does have jazz solos. But it's definitely focused on the groove and has pop sensibilities. you remember the classic Miles Davis quintet and then sextet from the late 50s? Well, if you're looking at this online or you have a video iPod, you can see the picture here with Miles Davis and John Coltrane. And the third member of this front line was Cannonball Adderley. Do you remember who's playing bass, drums, and piano? You should. So Cannonball is playing in this group, and after leaving this group, he formed a quintet with his brother, Nat Adderley, and with Bobby Timmons, who you've also heard, who wrote Moanin' with Art Blakey. A lot of their stuff was just hard, swinging, grooving jazz, just like Art Blakey was doing. But they actually get pretty close to soul here. Here's a video of the Cannonball song, Work Song. First thing you should notice is how catchy the tune is. It's a very bluesy, singable tune. Now listen to Cannonball's solo. Think of the words you might use to describe this solo. It's a little bit heavier sound than you heard from Lester Young or Charlie Parker. A little dirtier, maybe. Notice how it's right in the pocket. He's really, his rhythms are right with the drums. He's playing right with what the drums are doing. He's not floating over the bar line like Charlie Parker did. So people talk about this sound as a soulful sound, blues-drenched, dirty, gut bucket. Think about what words you might use. But it's certainly a darker sound than some of the cool jazz we were listening to. It doesn't sound at all like Paul Desmond. Listen to the drums, too. You should be able to hear every two and four. Doom. Call that the backbeat. Very strong in all pop music, in most jazz, and it's really very, very strong in this music. All right, next I want you to meet Illinois Jacquet. It's actually from Louisiana, but he went to high school in Houston. So we call this the Texas tenor style. He plays the tenor sax. It's sort of a wild, even more screeching in the groove kind of playing. He played with Cab Calloway and with Basie and with Lionel Hampton. Here's Illinois Jacquet. This is called Soul Explosion. Hope you can hear this is a blues. Okay, here's the solo by Illinois Jacquet. this kind of growling and honking, this extroverted style, extreme ranges, all of this feeds into rhythm and blues and certainly to rock and roll style. He does something here that's called false fingerings, right here. What he's doing is simply playing the same note with different fingerings, so he's changing the texture or the timbre, the sound of the note, not really the pitch of the note. Something that's very important in jazz and in rock. Just the sound. This is kind of a... He did it again. It's the same thing here. False fingering. It's much more about energy and the sound, the honking and growling is part of the attitude of this piece. Illinois Jacquet. You can see this soul jazz. You could easily see this on a jukebox in a popular music venue. Alright, so I'm going to call all of those things soul jazz. Those are all on the most commercial side of hard bop. Next, we're going to go to Horace Silver. We talked about Horace Silver in class the other day, but just to remind you, his sound fits right in here. This is Song from My Father, a catchy tune, his trademark doubling of the bass line on the piano. Here's Song from My Father. Horace Silver tune is a very, very memorable melodic line. Now listen to a bit of Horace Silver's funky piano playing in the solo. Got his trademark simple single finger licks in the right hand. You should have no problem distinguishing this from the frenetic Bud Powell. Okay, so the sign says I've now changed categories over into something I made up called lyrical hard bop. Now be careful. This is a spectrum. It's a spectrum I made up, so it's not as if all of a sudden pink stops being pink and now it's red. It's just gradually something moves over. So I'm not really sure we've crossed a line, but in this main category, I'd put most of the big names. Certainly Miles Davis, Art Blakey, Clifford Brown, Sonny Rollins, I'm all going to put in this category. All right, I'm going to play one Art Blakey piece. This is the version of Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers from 1958. It's a classic group with Lee Morgan on trumpet, Benny Golson playing tenor sax. This piece is called Moanin'. It's by Bobby Timmons, who's sitting in on the piano. You'd have no problem hearing the groove, how hard the band digs in, led by monster Art Blakey, the thunder on drums. Think about The fact this tune is called Moanin', what does that make you think of? And those amens that the band is playing. Here's Lee Morgan playing trumpet. Just like Cannonball Adderley thickened the sound of his instrument, Lee Morgan does the same thing. It's a middle range sound like Miles Davis, but it's not pretty. It's full of flats and heavier sounds. That's Lee Morgan's solo on Bobby Timmons' Moanin' by Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. I want to remind you how this all got started with Mr. Miles Davis. Here is Walkin'. Miles Davis in 1954, so it's a lot earlier than the other stuff we've been listening to. It's probably not quite as grooving, but it's pretty hard. This is the sextet with J.J. Johnson and Lucky Thompson. And there's Miles Davis on trumpet. He says it's Art Blakey on drums, but a lot of people think it's Kenny Clark on drums because it doesn't sound like Art Blakey. Now, Miles Davis always sounds a little cool. So, just from listening to the solo, I'm not sure you'd say, oh, yeah, this is hard bop. But from the beginning, the type of melody they play, how the drums are laying into the backbeat, Horace Silver there on piano, this is hard bop. But the sound of Lee Morgan you heard on the previous track is really much more the quintessential hard bop sound. So if you're still confused, go back and listen to Lee Morgan again with Art Blakey. We'll also come back to Lee Morgan in a minute. Next up is Clifford Brown. We listened to a bit of Clifford, and we listened to early Horace Silver and Art Blakey at Birdland. Like Miles, he has a very good mid-range sound, but he's also fast. He has an ability to create melody with a constant flow. There's a lot less space than there is with Miles. He also articulates a little bit stronger. Clifford Brown was a math student at Delaware and Maryland State Colleges, but he attracted attention because he was playing in the college jazz band, and so Dizzy Gillespie and then Fats Navarro both encouraged him to take up a career in music and to come on the road. So he left school and did just that. If you remember when I talked about the East Coast, West Coast thing and the Chico Hamilton band coming to play with his quintet to New York, the quintet he was opposite was this one with Clifford Brown and Max Roach. This is actually a piece by Clifford Brown. Here, it's a little like bebop, has a kind of angular melody, but it's a little bit slower, a little bit more melodic, a little easier to listen to. ¶¶
Okay.
Now let's listen to a bit of Clifford's solo. Listen to also how it's Max Roach playing drums, and they've still got his own bomb style, but the hits are a little less powerful, and he's kind of simplified it, smoothing out a little bit more. That even at this pretty good tempo, Clifford Brown always sounds wonderfully melodic. It's as if the whole thing was planned, but it was not. It's still an improvised solo. Clifford Brown was just a master melodist. On this recording, you listen to Clifford Brown. He's 25 years old. Unlike most of the other Blue Note artists, and almost everybody else we've talked about, he didn't do drugs, didn't do alcohol, he had a wife and a baby. As Sonny Rollins said, quote, Clifford was a profound influence on my musical life. He showed me it was possible to live a good, clean life and still be a good jazz musician. Then on Monday, June 26, 1956, 4 years after he first recorded, Clifford did a favor for a friend. He stayed in Philadelphia for a jam session, even though he'd had to drive all night to Chicago for the next gig. This was the last number they played, Donna Lee. You can hear his characteristic, almost staccato articulation, the way he bites off every note. In general, if I was in front of the jazz band and you were being in, I'd say, don't do that, don't do that. Make everything as lyrical as possible. Clifford makes it work. Someone once said that Clifford Brown always played as if he were playing for the last time. Well, this time he was. After playing that solo you just heard, he and Richie Powell and Richie's wife Nancy got into Powell's new car with Nancy driving. They had to drive all night to get to Chicago, remember? But it began to rain. The car skidded off the road and all three of them died. Dizzy Gillespie got the news as he was about to go on to the Apollo in Harlem. When the curtain rose, most of the band was in tears. For his artistry, Gillespie said, there will be no replacement. Had he lived, Clifford Brown would have been the trumpeter of his generation in the sound of hard bop. Instead, the typical sound of hard bop came to be identified with the rougher, more bluesy sound of Lee Morgan. You've already heard Lee playing with Art Blakey. He'd played with Dizzy Gillespie before that. Lee lost a few years to drugs and came back with his biggest hit, Sidewinder, in 1963. Always an inventive hard bop swinger, he became more adventurous during the 1960s, but he was shot dead by his mistress in January 1972. Here is his 60s hit, Cornbread, with Herbie Hancock on piano and Hank Mobley on tenor sax. Okay, so not exactly a hit. But you can hear the funky sound of this piece on the piano. Listen now to Lee Morgan's trumpet solo. Art Farmer and Benny Golson were both alums from Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, and in 1959, they formed the Jazz Tet. They re-recorded some Golson material that he'd written for Art Blakey, like the Blues March, and also some new material. Here's a classic Jazz Tet piece called Killer Joe. It has Art Farmer on trumpet, Benny Golson on tenor sax, Curtis Fuller on trombone, McCoy Tyner on piano, Addison Farmer on bass, and Lex Humphreys on drums, recorded in 1960. Now, why isn't this music cool? It's hard bop, both because of the hard groove and the very singable, simple tune. Listen to Art Farmer's short solo. Golson on tenor sax. Curtis Fuller on trombone. All right, you won't find a smoother, more swinging band than that. Great melodic soloist Art Farmer, Benny Golson, and trombonist Curtis Fuller. All right, now we're going to learn about Wes Montgomery, one of the great guitarists in mainstream jazz. Here is Wes playing Willow Weep for Me. Wes Montgomery obviously plays the electric guitar. First, he really plays melodies, and he swings hard. He makes the guitar into a solo instrument. Now, this piece is from a live session. So what you're listening to is a live quartet recording that Wes Montgomery made. Here, however, is the record that was actually released and what everybody heard. So all those extra horn lines, the extra flutes, all that stuff was added later in the studio without Wes Montgomery. So for some, this makes the album a more commercial album, and the original is the purer version. But in most commercial music, most rock and roll, it's really the final product that matters. It doesn't matter how much editing the Beatles did. It's the final record that we care about. But in jazz, this is very controversial. I'm not sure if we've really crossed a line into angstbach, bop, or something a little bit harder, but here's Jackie McLean. Jackie has a unique sound. He plays the alto sax, but he always plays a little bit sharp. It's a little out of tune, which adds a bit of intensity to it. He played with Art Blakey in 56 to 58 and made 21 albums for Blue Note. Here he is playing with pianist Larry Willis. This was recorded in 1965. This is a Jackie McLean composition, Echo. Now we come to Sonny Rollins. You've already heard a lot of Sonny playing with Clifford Brown and in other bands. Sonny's still going strong. I think he's going to be 76 this year. An original and inventive player. He would often develop simple melodies and then play them in inversion, play them backwards, do other things to them. He's one of the few hard boppers to favor staccato over legato, much like Clifford Brown. He has a hard, sort of dry, aggressive sound. This piece you're listening to is called Blue Seven. It's a very controversial piece because it had, in an analysis by Gunther Schuller, an analysis you should read, it's in your course notes, by the way, he said, with Rollins' thematic and structured unity have at last achieved the importance in pure improvisation that elements such as swing, melodic conception, and originality of expression have already enjoyed for many years. So using motivic analysis, Schuller demonstrated the structural cohesiveness of this Rollins improvisation. And that inspired lots of other people to come and look at solos for the melodic configuration and how the piece was all tied together by the various bits of melody. Well, you can hear this in the piece. Notice the way Rollins returns to this little bit of melody. Thank you. you've just been listening, that's okay. But that little dee-bop-bop keeps coming back in various forms. And that's what Günther Schuller heard that Sonny Rollins was doing throughout this piece. So by the end of the 1950s, Sonny Rollins was being compared to John Coltrane. So everybody was a little shocked when he dropped out of the scene from 1959 to 1961. When he returned, he was a freer player who watched what Ornette Coleman was doing and continued to experiment. He retired again in 1968, but came back in 1971 doing something new. For a jazz musician, that's really important. Sonny Rollins. Here's one more saxophonist in this kind of edgier trio of saxophonists. This is Dexter Gordon. It's not somebody whose sound you're going to have to recognize for the exam, but he's one of my favorites. He plays way behind the beat, an edgier sound again. This is from the Our Man in Paris album. This is Willow Weep for Me. It's the same piece you heard Wes Montgomery do earlier in the podcast. Lastly, we're going to listen to Charles Mingus. I put him, again, across another imaginary line, the sort of experimentalist line, but again, it's a spectrum. I could have put Sonny Rollins here, too. Certainly Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, maybe even Horace Silver wrote pieces and did stuff that's further on this edgier side. Mingus was firstly an innovative and experimental bassist. He introduced pedal points, which is to play the same bass note under changing chords above it. He turned the bass into a percussive, harmonic, and edgy lead instrument. He was also a creative composer, mixing large numbers of styles, much like Ellington before him and Wynton Marsalis after him. He likes to mix meters and tempos, and you're going to hear all of that in this number, Better Get Hit in Your Soul, on the album Mingus, 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 Mingus. No ego problem here. Notice how the band keeps playing in the fast three, but the drums now drop the tempo to a slow swing. They're related, but two different things are going on. In many ways, this is like a bassy riff tune, but the riff is ferocious, and the riffs on top of it have a little bit more edge to them, and eventually we get two solos going on at the same time. So you can hear how the band is going through a series of tempo and time changes. Eventually, he gets back to the basic melody. Ferocious as ever, except at this time, he lets the tempo and the melody slow down. But it's not over yet. Mingus has a little bit of churchy country jazz left in him. We're going to come back to Mingus again in the Free Jazz Week in a couple of weeks. Coltrane should be here too, but we're going to talk about him for a whole week next week. So first ask yourself, is this a good classification system? Based upon what? How did I decide to do this particular taxonomy? Because you need to understand in any system, what are the guiding principles? What are the other principles that you could adopt to make another system? Don't worry at all about the difference between hard bop, funky, soul, jazz, experimental, all of those terms. I won't ask you the difference on the exam, even if we could agree upon it. All the music we talked about here in this podcast is pretty funky in the original meaning of that word. Deep down, bluesy, soulful, emotional, deep in the groove. Some of it's a bit more funky or bluesy, like Cannonball Adderley or Lee Morgan or Bobby Timmons. And so sometimes we call that soul jazz. But there's no sharp point at which hard bop becomes soul jazz or funky jazz. The whole thing is just a spectrum. And maybe there really isn't any difference. Although I would argue that the funkiest hard bop, the stuff we first talked about, is going to reemerge and merge with rhythm and blues in what we call soul, James Brown, or soul jazz. So we were going to be returning to Jimmy Smith, Horace Silver, Illinois Jacquette, and Maceo Parker, who is James Brown's music director, in the last week of the course when we explore connections between the current soul or groove bands like Galactic or Grey Boy All-Stars. Another thing that makes this period a little difficult, as we now get to the late 1950s, early 1960s, is that all these things are still going on at the same time. We were going to have hard bop, cool, never gave up, third stream. We have post-boppers going on like Coltrane. Ornette Coleman is going to start doing free jazz. Latin jazz, bossa nova is going to start any minute. The big bands are still going. So all the stuff is going on at once. So we're going to lose that nice, clean succession of first there's New Orleans, then there's Chicago, then there's New York jazz, that sort of thing. Once again, one of our big questions this week is how is this music, how is hard bop related to cool, or how is it connected to bop? Is it a reaction to cool? Is it a reaction to bop? If you can think of better questions to ask about this music, you'll be able to dig a little deeper. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this. Again, you don't have to know all of these names or sounds for the exam, but I wanted to give you an idea of the general style of hard bop, and you can best gain that by listening to a spectrum of the music. See you in class.